Thank you, Steve.
Did you forget how to do it?
Today is a strange day because it's Teachers Institute Day. You're only here for half the day, and I'm only here for half the day.
Why did you put me here first? You're the one who wanted to whine about it and say, how are we going to make it to the wedding on time?
I'm working a full day.
I know
you are, Steve.
In fact, that's what started this whole thing. It was Steve said, are you going to go home in between work and the wedding? And I said, no, Jim's going to meet me on the train. And then I'm thinking, what am I going to do for 2 hours?
Mm-hmm.
And then
almost three. Well, an hour, I guess, yeah. For travel. Kevin's getting married at 6 o'clock, which is it's kind of a strange time, especially.
It's good for them.
It's great for them. But they were being inconsiderate. They were not thinking about you and me and Steve.
At least they didn't have it on a holiday.
No, that's true, isn't it?
But
that would have been tough.
Steve said that. We started thinking, and then Bill's like, well, my wife has to work to, I don't know. And then you say to me, do you think I could leave a couple hours early? I said, no, if you're leaving a couple hours early, so
you
am I.
You have to also. That's
so
fair.
So Kevin's wedding has been planned for many months now.
Yes. I know. And, I feel a little guilty about that.
And you guys decided yesterday to ask for time off.
Yes.
Okay.
And you're blaming me for
no,
the
no, no,
very
no.
last
no, no,
no.
I'm not finished with the story. Oh. So you got us, you know, as usual, you got mine and Bill's wheels turning. Because you do that every day. So then when we went up to talk to Stephanie about leaving early, she said, well, I'll just have Bertrand do it. And I said, right. Okay, we can't screw him because he is the one who started this.
Right.
So I saved you, Steve.
Here's the wild card in all this.
Thank you, Wendy.
It's that the Cubs game should be ending right around the time that we'd all be trying to get to the wedding site.
Man.
So traffic is going to be really difficult.
What time should I leave to get there by 6?
I'd leave now. I think it's 10 after 10. I think you should probably head out now just to be safe.
Oh, those Cubs. See? Yeah. See why I'm a Sox fan?
Is this why? Is this the reason why?
I'm not going for winning. I'm going for convenience.
Which of us is going to arrive the latest?
You guys put money on me not making it at 6 o'clock.
It's the weirdest thing. You know how usually if you make a bet with somebody, one person bets one way, the other person bets the other way. Steve and I both have bets that you will be late. So I don't know how we're going to settle that.
I won't be late.
When I put my money down, I didn't realize you guys were going to prep for a week.
That does change the bet a little bit. Because we thought we'd be leaving here at normal time, a little after 3.
Which would give you 3 hours to go 40 blocks.
Yeah.
Which means I probably would have been on time had I worked both shifts. But
I don't see it.
Coming from LaGrange to go to where we have to go, to Cubbyville.
Right.
I might be late.
At the IHOP.
You cannot be late now. If you are late now.
No. I know. I said that to Jim. I said they all have money on me being late. And he goes, that's not going to happen. You put the competition on. He's the one who always runs late.
It's him? It's not you, it's him?
Well, it's kind of both of us. So that's really a double jeopardy. Okay.
So 3 minutes ago, it was my fault that the schedule is upended.
Now it's
Jim's fault that you guys are late.
Right.
Boy, I've spent for the last 2 years telling people in my family, own up to your mistakes, don't blame others, and look what I'm doing.
Sure. Well, I railed yesterday about how lazy a society we've become. And I have to leave from work 2 hours early to get to a wedding that then won't be for 4 extra hours. But
I don't even understand you're doing it. Me, I have to go home and put my fake tan stuff on, take a shower, do my makeup perfectly.
ABC News in New York.
I'm answering to ABC News in New York, who said that I need to cover it. Why is that? Jake Tapper and I are covering it together.
Sometimes Jake just talks to us over the intercom so we know what's going on.
Right.
Sorry about that.
That's my fault.
I think it comes down more to the fact that my wife doesn't want to drive separately. Like, originally I was going to do what you were going to do and just meet her there, but she said it'd be better if we, you know, drove together and stuff. So that's the problem we're having.
So should I ask?
And that makes it better?
To arrive with me?
Well, I know that's the optimum choice,
right.
But sometimes you have
to
meet up.
She thinks there's going to be a red carpet. Like, she thinks it's an award show, and she wants, when Billy Bush interviews me, she wants to be next to me.
I'm thinking I might ask Stephanie if I can leave early.
You should leave early too, Steve.
Right.
Well, so we have Mark Carmen and Amy Guth that will be filling
They're
in
gonna
for
fill
us
in.
Later.
Oh, I definitely got to get out of here.
They're going to fill. Oh, you should. Yeah.
Judy will come in early for you.
Ask her. She'll
Dead
do
air.
It. I know. It got really quiet, didn't it? I know that. I know. So I'm looking forward to tonight. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. You pointed out the other day, as Sarah joined us on the show on Friday and we did a little segment about how well she knows Kevin, you said it's like two models are getting married. They're very attractive people, but they're not just attractive people. They're both very, very nice people, don't you think? They're
great people. Oh, smart, funny. They really, I really feel like Kevin is our son and we're old enough to be his parents.
We are older than his parents, as he points out from time to time.
Well, he's not listening, do you think, right?
No, it just bugs me. When we found that out, we said, boy, we're old enough to be your parents when he first started working with us.
Yeah.
And just for like kind of things and giggles, I said, how old are your parents? And he mentioned an age that was younger than us, and we looked at each other and said, he's fired.
I lost a lot of respect for him at that moment. I always liked him, but I don't like him as much, but I still do like him. But yeah, that's hurtful.
Yeah, I know. I'm old enough to be his parents' parents.
Not that old.
Thank God.
Not in this state. There's regions of the country where that might be true, but not here.
Are we younger than his grandparents?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
By a couple of years. A couple of years.
It's like our little Kevin's getting married.
I know. Though. Will you cry at the ceremony?
Every time.
Steve, will you cry at the ceremony?
I really like Kevin. So
what does that mean?
I just think he's such a great guy, and so I'm not betting against it.
Yep. I may cry.
We're all little marshmallow centers when it comes to love, honestly. There's nothing better.
I once cried at a wedding where I didn't know the people getting married. One of them was a friend of my wife's when we attended the wedding, and I found myself a little weepy, and
I've
went,
done that.
Why would I cry at this wedding? I don't know either one of these people.
Because it reminds you of your wedding day.
Oh, maybe
and the
that's
love
part
and
of
the
it.
Vows that were exchanged and the commitment you've made to one another. I didn't cry on my wedding day. I floated down the aisle, though. I really did.
Yeah. I remember
they'd
seeing
had,
that.
You know,
special effects.
Right. But it was fantastic.
There was an ice machine, and you were on a roller skate.
And then she did that spin when she got to the top.
Right.
I did. I floated down the aisle. It was just amazing. And I thought I would cry.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful day.
They have that thing where you're not supposed to see the bride the day of, right? So, well, we lived together, so I did see her the morning of course.
And then your marriage has lasted?
I know. We broke the tradition.
Against all odds.
But then, like, I had seen her dress, but I had not seen her in her dress. And then, you know, the way the tradition is the guy's there at the altar first. Not the altar. We didn't get married in a church, but where the altar would be. And then when she made her entrance, it just hit me. Like, all of a sudden, it's like, this is real. This is not a game.
It's no turning back.
It's the only specific moment I remember of my wedding.
Was seeing Sharon?
Right.
Yeah.
The rest instantly, is a blur. I can recall it, yeah.
I hope Kevin has a good photographer. I don't even know if ours is still in business, Joe Palladino, but he captured Jim's face when Jim saw me walking down the aisle. It is a priceless picture.
I remember saying, and my best man also remembers this because I'm like, did I say what I thought I said? I just said, wow. You know, like
that's original.
I know I should because I like to consider myself a fairly creative person. You would have thought something more profound would have come to me at that specific moment. But
God, zoinks.
Right. Zoink Scoob, it's my wife. Yeah, something.
Not yet.
Soon to be. But it like hit me all of a sudden. Oh. I have done okay. You know, this isn't a bad thing that's going on.
She did
here.
Pretty well too, Bill. If I must say so myself.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then there's a lot more show coming up. So stay where you are. It's Teachers Institute Day. We're only here for half the day. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Our little Kevin is getting married tonight.
Yep.
It's the start of a new life together with his lovely bride to be, Sarah.
I know they're showing it live on CLTV. So consult your local listings.
I know when Kevin was talking about his wedding, I was kind of complaining because I have one kid in an improv show at his high school. I have another kid that's in Springfield, Illinois, who comes home tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And how am I going to be in three places at once? And you kind of complained because you said the Cubs game is going to be getting out when we're trying to get there.
It'll make getting there a little bit more of a challenge, but whatever, that's fine.
Well, always legendary Springfield. Our junior high takes a yearly trip there, and Dylan is on his trip, and he comes home today sometime. And I got a phone call from him yesterday saying, Mom, I need you to talk to the teacher. Well, right away I'm thinking, uh-oh.
This will not be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, what's up? He goes, well, there's a souvenir I want to get. And I said, okay, why do I have to talk to the teacher? And he said, because it's a pocket knife.
Oh.
And I said, I don't think that's really a good thing to buy while on a school trip.
Right.
And Dylan says, no, 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 there are other kids calling their moms. We just need permission. And then the teachers are going to hold on to them. And when we return, they'll give them to us there. So we won't have them on the whole trip. So I'm thinking, well, that makes perfect sense.
Sure.
So I'm, Dylan, I got to get back on the air here, you know. And, okay, well, you can just text that it's okay. And mm-hmm. I said, no, I think I'd like to talk to the teacher. So he said, all right, but if you have to get back on the air, I said, I have a minute. So I'm waiting. I hear this teacher and a whole bunch of guys and little boys in the background. And then I hear Dylan say, okay, you can talk to my mom now. And she said, about what? About getting the pocket knife. And she says, oh, no, we're not getting that pocket knife. And he just went, okay, click.
That's the end.
Hung up on me.
Oh.
So I bring this up to Jim, and I said, you know, it seemed odd to me that they'd let him get a pocket knife on a school trip, even with parental permission.
Sure.
And he said, you know, that pocket knife that's over in the other, in the Star Wars room, it's on a little counter of the Star Wars room. I said, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. He goes, you know, the one we use when we're fishing to cut the worms. I said, yeah. He said, where do you think I got that? I said, I don't know. He goes, my eighth grade field trip,
oh,
our school trip,
it's a tradition.
All the boys bought pocket knives.
No,
And he went to a Catholic school.
Yeah.
So why did they allow that?
Oh, I don't know.
A chalice I could see, but right. A pocket knife?
Doesn't Dylan already have a pocket knife? Didn't you tell
this
me
this one
he's
was pretty
one?
Cool. I have to tell you, he sent me a little picture of it, and it had a hammer. It had...
So he can hammer in the morning.
Right. It was a hammer on one side. It was something on the other side, and then the hammer and the other thing came together as pliers as well.
Oh.
Very handy. Our own Kevin Richter used to have a...
He carries one often. I never had one. I know my dad from the time he was a kid until, I believe, this day.
Because he whittled, didn't he?
My dad, a big whittler. Yeah. Almost on the U.S. Olympic whittling team. He lost it in the last heat. He lost. But he... And it was the weirdest thing because I'm never in a situation where I need one.
Kevin has used his all the time.
I've seen him use it.
It's like, do you have a bottle opener? Yes, I do.
Right.
Pulls out his pocket knife.
Oh, there's a bear coming. Pulls out his pocket knife.
Do you have any scissors? He pulls out
right.
his pocket knife.
It's right. on his desk, too, in there. I was kind of intimidated when I sat there.
No, you're allowed to use it,
show.
Joey.
I am? Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, you're filling in for him. You can use his knife. But my dad had one of those, similar to a Swiss Army knife, but I think that's a brand name. I think some
right.
of them are different, where they do have, there's cuticle scissors in there. There's
I know.
A wrench. There's a blender. If you want to make a Mai Tai or something, you can just put it on blender.
I would want one of those.
But I don't, I've never been in a situation where I felt like I needed one.
Yeah.
I carry a machete with me at all times, but a pocket knife seems silly.
Well, it fits in your cargo shorts pocket.
Yes, easily. I could put two of them in there.
Bertrand, did you ever have a pocket knife? Because I just feel like that's like more our generation or probably before.
Even prior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did I ever have a what?
A pocket knife.
If I did, it was momentary. My wife loves them.
They're pretty cool.
You know what I like, and it's not, I mean, it's in the same family. If you go to a place that sells Swiss Army knives, if you go to a jeweler or a department store that sells it, they have this display, I'm sure you've seen it, with a pocket knife that's about 10 times the size of a normal one, and thanks to electronics, it keeps on spinning and opening, and it shows you all the different options. Sometimes as a kid, now keep in mind if you're a young person listening to the show, these were simpler times. We didn't have the internet. I would just go to a department store if my parents were shopping there and just watch the display for a while, like 5 or 10 minutes. Just watch the knife spin around and the various options open up to me.
I can't find the picture of there was pliers on one side or a hammer on one side and I don't know if it was a screwdriver.
It couldn't be a powerful hammer. It's too small, right?
No, like, but you know, you never know when you're going to need it. But it turns out he bought a pocket watch.
Oh. So he just wanted something with
the
word pocket.
To put it in his pocket. Yes, right. Too bad they didn't sell the pocket fisherman there. it says Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and it's a nice little pocket watch.
Oh.
And I said, wow, that's cool.
Oh, Wendy's showing me a picture of it. It looks great. It looks
yeah,
very
dated. Yeah,
but
does an 8th grade boy really want that?
No, it seems like something somebody from an Agatha Christie novel would have. It seems very like 1912 to me.
Maybe he bought a monocle in Legendary Springfield as well. But they're having a great time. So
that's good.
It's a great little place to go on your 8th grade field trip.
Yeah, It is. So, it's perfect for that.
So no pocket knife, but he did get a pocket watch.
That's fine. It's close enough. Safer, probably.
Yep.
Is it a stovepipe pocket watch?
Yes.
That would be a good idea. You should market those. Does Steve Bertrand Travel go to Legendary Springfield?
He will if he can sell some stovepipe pocket watches.
That changes everything, does it, Steve? It does.
Yeah.
All right, we need to take a quick break. Steve has the news, and then a lot more show coming your way next. It's Bill Leff, and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Devo all together on a Friday. If you want to jump in.
Whip it good.
Whip it good. If you're going to whip it good. 312-981-7200. Are we not men? We are Devo.
D-E-V-O.
Yep.
Nice flower pot hat.
Thank you. I'm wearing it to the wedding later. I wanted to try it out and you tell me if you thought it looked good or not. It is a formal wedding, so I went with the flower pot hat. Steve, you were involved in a story earlier this morning. I was listening to Steve Cochran's show. And during Steve Grzanich's news, there was a special report by you. And here's what the story is. And I'd love to explore this for just a little bit because it's incredibly disturbing. Both Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth, who are running for the U.S. Senate.
Fabricators.
Let's go with fabricators. Both Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth, who are running for the U.S. Senate, have each told a story about their whereabouts on September 11th. They've each told stories about where they were and what they were doing on September 11th, on the September 11th, not just this past one, on the September 11th. But research shows that Mark Kirk's story is not correct, and research shows that Tammy Duckworth's story is not correct. Disturbing or not disturbing?
Pretty technicalities.
How does this keep happening with politicians? How do they remember things that are, to be kind, just a little bit off in terms of
Haven't
facts?
Haven't you ever puffed up your resume? That's what this is like.
Well, okay, so each of the stories, they're different, and you can judge for yourself how egregious or understandable or whatever. But Mark Kirk was at the Pentagon with other members of Congress on September 11th, and Donald Rumsfeld was holding a briefing with them,
mm-hmm.
and Senator Kirk says that he was in the room when Rumsfeld was notified of the second tower being hit.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew the first tower was hit. People didn't know, you know, if that was an attack or an accident or whatever. He says he was in the room in the meeting there when Rumsfeld was notified, and we all knew we were under attack. The 9/11 Commission, their sort of TikTok of Rumsfeld Day, had him out of that meeting when he was told of the second attack. So he wasn't with Mark Kirk at the time. Kirk's campaign says, well, you know, Kirk was still in the meeting when they found out, and it was his recollection that Secretary Rumsfeld was there as well.
I could see that.
Tammy Duckworth has said on the campaign trail that she was in charge of the Black Hawk helicopter contingency at Midway Airport, which she was.
Mm-hmm.
And on September 11th, you know, no one knew more than her what it meant, and she was had to prepare to go in the air and to defend Chicago, one of the largest cities in the country.
Except that
she was backpacking in Scotland at the time.
Okay.
But now, technically still in charge, as
her
she
campaign
says.
Says she was in charge, and she was thinking those things, and she was desperately trying to find a way back.
I could see that too. But it's embellished.
Doesn't it seem though? And I don't know exactly what they'd gain from this. Doesn't it seem like they have embellished these stories just a little bit? Just a little bit?
I mean, to leave out the part that you were in another country and not driving to 55th and Cicero.
Right,
or whatever,
that's a difference.
That's a pretty significant thing, I think, yeah.
That's, you know, I thought she was out on the Southwest side.
So it would certain now. All right, let me go back in time just a little bit. I know that was an incredibly traumatic day for everybody on so many different levels. Like for many of us, one of the most traumatic days of our lives. However, I'm maybe I'm the exception to the rule on this. Can't you remember almost everything that happened in sequence on that day? Because it's ingrained in my memory and it'll never go away.
Yes,
like
every
step of it, right?
Where we were, what we thought, right. Who ended up telling us about the second plane.
Well, it's funny you say that. So can I tell you my story real quick?
Yeah,
sure.
Because this is a thing that happened, and years later I think this couldn't have happened. I was in the newsroom, and it was about, it was after the Pentagon plane had crashed. So this was, you know, well into it. Both towers had been hit. And I don't remember if Senator Durbin called us or if we called him, but I was talking to Senator Durbin.
Yeah.
And I said, "Senator, how are you?" And he said, "Well, you know, we're in the Capitol. We're in, you know, in the basement of the Capitol," I think is what he said. And I said, "Well, the Pentagon has been hit." And he said, "What?" And I said, "It looks like the plane has hit the Pentagon." And he said, "Well, we could see the smoke here, and we thought it was the State Department."
So
when I tell my story, I'm the guy who told, you know, a sitting senator that the Pentagon had been bombed.
Yeah.
And I ran into him a couple of years ago. I said, "Did that really happen? Because that doesn't seem possible." And he doesn't have a sharp. He says, "Yeah, I think that's probably the way it worked." But so things were fuzzy, too, because so much was happening so fast.
Okay, but you knew, the point was, you knew you were in the newsroom.
I knew I was in the newsroom.
Your whereabouts were accounted for.
And Kirk knew he was, had been at the Pentagon, or had been in a, maybe he wasn't even at the Pentagon, it was a meeting with Rumsfeld earlier
that day. But the small details are gray.
Yeah,
right. But in both of these, actually, Tammy Duckworth's, I guess you could argue,
the weather's gray,
a lot more extreme.
Seem pretty suspect when, you know, I was at Midway Airport was mentioned, and she wasn't at Midway Airport.
Well, she didn't say she was at Midway. She said, "I commanded the Black Hawk contingent at Midway."
So is that just clever wording? What would you write that out as?
She was in charge of it. And it was going on at Midway. She didn't say she was or wasn't at Midway.
But you would almost want to, although I guess if you're going for Patriot points, you want to leave it vague. But if you're going for accuracy, you say, "Look, I was out of the country at the time, but I was still in some sort of command."
Right.
But that doesn't paint you as patriotic. Although Mark Kirk has a little bit of a history, does he not, Steve?
With some military details
that weren't quite accurate.
Yes, he does.
And he's apologized for them. I give him credit for that.
Is that okay, though, to just, "I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that"? I mean, I know that's what you do, but shouldn't you think before you issue a statement?
You would hope. But you know how that moment, and by moment I kind of mean that day, all of September 11th, became our generation's "Where were you when Kennedy was shot," where people remember the smallest of details for the rest of their lives just because it's such a jolt that you go, "Wow, this is embedded in my head forever."
Because it took us all by surprise.
Yeah. It's so disturbing to me. And I, you know, several times on the show when we've talked about politics, usually the presidential race, I say to myself, I miss the day when I trust. I don't know if there ever was a day where I trusted a politician, where a politician represented truth and honesty to me. Everybody now wants to bend the truth just a little bit. And I don't know, at some point you go, if you're a politician and you're talking about your whereabouts on September 11th, there's public record of what you were doing and where you were. Didn't you know that?
That's why people are in favor of Donald Trump, because of situations like this.
Because why? Explain. I'm not sure.
Just because you said, "When's the last time I trusted a politician?" So people are thinking, see why we don't want a politician?
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Well, okay, I get that, Wendy, but I don't think he's demonstrated that he's different than that.
No, but it's something different. And I'm going back to the very beginning when I thought it was a joke that he was running. And then it's like, wow, somebody who's not a politician, this intrigues me.
Right.
And then as the campaign went on, I thought, this doesn't intrigue me anymore. This scares me.
Right.
But I understand. At first, it sounds great. Oh, politicians lie. We can't trust them. Listen to all the lies. We need someone who's a non-politician. But then when push comes to shove, you want someone who's trained in how this whole thing runs.
You would hope?
I would hope, but I don't know.
And I full disclosure, at some point, I've interviewed both Mark Kirk and I've interviewed Tammy Duckworth, and I like them both.
I do,
they're
too.
They're both
very likable.
They are.
Absolutely.
They're very likable, and they have both made tremendous sacrifices.
And
they
have
really
done
have.
Good.
So it just disturbs me that something like this, which really in the scheme of things, it's not the biggest deal in the world if they've embellished a little bit about September 11th. It sets a bad precedent.
They?
I don't know. That's the part I can't figure
What's
out.
What's wrong with Tammy Duckworth saying, "I was heartbroken. I wasn't in the country when it was attacked, but I did what I needed to do and commanded the fleet at Midway Airport."
So much better.
Yeah.
That seems.
And then it's out in the open. There's no questions asked.
Right. No one would ever say, I don't think anyone would ever say, "I would never vote for Tammy Duckworth on September 11th. She wasn't even in the country." Who would say that?
No one, because you didn't know this was going to happen.
Right. Right.
I'm with you, Bill. I don't know. But I am the queen of too much information. So I would offer way too much information, and people would go, stop your yapping.
What you were wearing at the time.
Yes.
How much you saved on that outfit.
Right.
Right. Right. There are people that want to be heard about this, and I don't blame you. 312-981-7200. What are your thoughts on this? Some slight embellishments about September 11th from two of the people running for the Senate for the state of Illinois. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. All right, it's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder, and we're telling you the story. It was reported earlier. Our own Steve Bertrand did the story earlier on Steve Cochran's show. Two of your candidates for U.S. Senate from the state of Illinois, that would be Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth, both tell stories about their whereabouts and what exactly was going on September 11th. However, it turns out both Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth have slightly embellished those stories.
I want to be clear, too. It's a Chicago Tribune story.
It is.
Yeah,
right.
They're the ones reporting it.
Okay. All right.
I don't want to take credit for it.
No, but I saw
Steve
I've seen
Bertrand
it.
Breaks the story.
I have since seen it in the Tribune, but my first access to it was through you, Steve, on Steve's show earlier.
Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
What are your thoughts on this?
There's a big discrepancy. I mean, to remember who was in a room, you know, 15 years ago at a meeting is easy to forget who was there. But remembering whether or not you were in the country is a big leap there.
Although she didn't technically say, I was in the country. It's the wording that made us assume she was over at Midway.
When she was in Scotland. Yeah.
When she was in Scotland, which are the operative words there, when she was in Scotland. So was she in Scotland or was she in the United States?
She was in Scotland. So would you, here I guess this is the basic question here is, it wouldn't take away from her at all. If you were on the fence trying to decide who to vote for between Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth, you wouldn't, who would say, Tammy Duckworth was in Scotland on the most important day.
Shame on her.
I can't vote for her.
Well, it's not shame on her so much as where she was. It's the memory of where she was and recounting where she was accurately and appropriately.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
Well, she didn't say she was at Midway, just to be clear. She did not say she was there.
That part was left out.
She just said she was commanding the Blackhawk helicopters at Midway.
Yeah.
The Blackhawk helicopters were at Midway.
She wasn't.
Right.
Right.
But she wasn't, again, which is the operative fact, is that she wasn't in the country. And she couldn't remember that she was not in the country. Is that the issue?
That's,
no.
The issue is basically that...
She didn't disclose it.
It was, yeah, it's not full disclosure.
She was just coloring it. She left out a piece of the story. You know, she said, I, in my mind, knew what it's like to have to defend the city. I was worried about Chicago. And the implication is that she was on her way to Midway to man these helicopters when she wasn't actually doing that. She may have been having those thoughts, but she was in Scotland.
And again, which is the operative fact, is that she was in Scotland and kind of left that fact out.
And Bill's right. I mean, really, you go, my heart is broken that we were attacked and I wasn't there to help defend our country.
That's how you spin it.
Perfect.
That's the better way.
And it's true.
Right.
Thank you so much, Marianne. We appreciate your call. And this is Ellen. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just wanted to say something about memory. And it's been shown time and again that the more you think about a certain memory, the less accurate it becomes. So, you know, you can sit there and say you have this exact memory of where you were, but if you checked it with other people, they would have a slightly different memory. So like with Hillary Clinton, when she got all those complaints about her not remembering that she didn't come in under fire, there was somebody else who was on the plane that talked about what a briefing they got before they landed about what to do if they did come in under fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so her memory of it becomes, oh my God, there's going to be fire all around here. And so it's, you know, there, I don't think people are really trying to be deceptive in a lot of cases. I think we misremember things.
Ellen, you just jogged my memory about something. Like if you, Terry, were you with your wife, Terry, at the time of 9/11 when
in
the attacks?
In Florida, Yes.
Okay, so that's in Florida. But it would be interesting to have, like, your account and her account, and I was with Jim to hear his account and my account. It would be...
See how they differ.
It would be vaguely... It would probably be very, very similar, but, you know, then it's thinking, oh, did we... Were we driving into the city when they called and said, don't go to work? You know, there might be variables that are off a little.
Sure.
But I do feel, Ellen, that you would remember where you were.
Yeah, but you just got through saying she did not say that she wasn't at Midway.
Correct.
I mean, in her mind, the important part of that story may be how she had to try and coordinate all this stuff.
While
and
being
really
out of town.
Matter.
But then say that. That makes it look even more impressive. Like, I was out of the country and had to orchestrate all these things. That even makes her look better, doesn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, but maybe in retrospect she'd say that. But at the time she was interviewed, she was really focused on what, you know, how difficult it was to just organize all these people.
Point well taken.
You know, I don't know, but I'm just saying, I don't think people, I think if you put everything everybody said under a microscope or remembered under a microscope, you would get really different stories.
I think you're absolutely right on that, Ellen. Thank you very much for calling.
Okay, bye.
All right, Bill, we have time for one more.
Oh, choose whichever one you think is best. They're all good.
Oh, I don't know where to go.
I just, as we play this out, I think about Brian Williams, who was the NBC news anchor at the time, who had memories of things that weren't quite accurate in several situations, and it cost him his job over at NBC News. I mean, he has since worked at MSNBC, and he's doing fine over there.
It wasn't just once, though.
Right,
that's
it was a couple times. So, you know, at some point, I understand how your memory can change, your memory can be a little bit different, but there are certain positions, politician being one of them, news anchor being one of them, where your memory is a very important tool, and it needs to be fairly accurate, doesn't it?
And it's different. Brian Williams, you know, you would expect it to be actual. An entertainer might embellish just
right.
to make the story better.
Right.
But someone like that, you trust to recount the actual details
yeah.
of the event itself. Let's take Tim. Last call on this. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Great, Tim. What's up?
Well, I'm calling just because I've always been a fan of Mark Kirk.
Yeah.
It shook our faith and confidence quite a bit when he embellished his service.
Yes.
But his nomination was responsible for getting my son into the Naval Academy. And I appreciate Tammy Duckworth's service as well and the sacrifice that she's made. But I will just say, from a military family, my father was an officer, my son was an officer. These guys are trained to know and to be able to explain with exact detail and clarity about specific events that they were a part of.
Yeah.
And it just bothers me that they would embellish a story for political reasons. I mean, both, you know, I don't know if Mark's is more egregious than Tammy's or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it's just really bothersome, again, in this political environment, that somebody just, these guys are officers. They knew better. They know better.
Yeah, accountability is everything. And as you pointed out, they both have a military background and understand the implications of where you are, when, and with
exact
who.
Exact details.
That's so important. So, I'm with you all the way, Tim. I really am.
Well, thanks very much for
thank
hearing
you.
Me out.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks for your service, too. We thank
absolutely.
You and your son.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a break. We've got news coming up in just a little bit. Steve with the news and then more show. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and it's Friday, and that means a visit with our friend Kurt Wagner of TVShowPatrol.com. Kurt, how are you?
Hello,
everything
I'm great.
Good?
Happy Friday. Happy Fuzzy Friday. You didn't shave. Thank you.
Well, the Hawks are in the playoffs, right?
Yes. So is this your playoff beard?
Yes.
That's the most optimistic thing I've ever heard you say. That's very nice of you. Wow, you got to jump on the rest of the city, Kurt. Hey, excellent.
I love it.
I'm getting started early. It takes so long.
Excellent. Good for you. Boy, I hate to do this. I hate to start off the segment on a sad note, but this is very sad news that came across the wires this morning. And that is that Terry Jones, one of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, is suffering from dementia, which is terrible. A couple of years ago at another radio station, Terry Jones was in town and we had him up and we get to interview Terry Jones. And I've met four of the Pythons. He was the last so far. And what a nice man he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very sad. He's 74 years old, and he is suffering from primary progressive aphasia. That is a form of dementia. Those guys, the Python guys, revolutionized comedy.
Yes.
They really did.
And 74 is so young, really.
I remember we couldn't, my brother and I could not wait to watch that every time, you know, every week.
It was Sunday like, nights at that was 10:30,
like a, yeah,
right?
That was like an event thing.
You didn't grow up in Chicago, so where you were, was it also on, as Wendy said, here it was on Sunday nights at 10:30. Was it on the same, do you remember, by
it
you?
It could have been Sunday nights because we wouldn't have gotten to stay up for it, although I used to sneak behind the couch a lot. And
oh.
When I was supposed to be sleeping. Watching. Yeah, oh. Watch what my parents were. But it must have been on a different time because we used to, it used to be a appointment TV thing for us.
Yeah.
And while watching it, I had a tough time interpreting the British accent. So we were little when it was on.
Right.
And I really had a tough time figuring out what they were saying. So I would just laugh when my mom and sister laughed.
That's perfect.
And we still have a penguin. My sister has a penguin on her telly.
Yeah.
There was a sketch. What's on the telly? I do believe it's a penguin. So yeah. We have a cast iron penguin on our television because of that show.
If you'll remember, PBS back then, or especially WTTW here in Chicago, had a block of British comedies.
Yeah.
It was No Honestly. It was the Dave Allen Show.
I loved that show.
It was the Two Ronnies.
Yeah.
And it was Monty Python.
Fawlty Towers.
Fawlty Towers for a little bit. I think there's only 7 or 8 episodes of Fawlty Towers, so they'd run through that one pretty quickly. But
well, that was the Fawlty Towers.
John Cleese.
Yeah, he was a Monty Python guy too. Yeah. Yeah. And you know the movies too.
Oh my God.
So funny.
Some of my favorite.
Yeah.
Sad news.
We've only lost one member of Monty Python. Grant Chapman is no longer with us. But we're just coming out today that Terry Jones, one of the founding members, one of the members of Monty Python, is suffering from dementia. That's very sad. You pointed this out last week, and now you've come up with data to prove your theory. Television has this weird love relationship with movies. If something did well at the box office, TV says, well, let's kind of do a version of that. And boy, is that going on a lot right now.
And it's nothing new, I guess. I mean, TV adapts from books and old TV shows and movies all the time. But right now, it seems like there's a huge amount of them.
You know, sometimes, and it doesn't happen often, but sometimes it's a better version when a movie goes to television. The one that comes to mind immediately is MASH. MASH was a good movie, a Robert Altman film years and years ago. When it came to TV, they really got to explore the characters, right. And it was so much better.
Well, that TV show became kind of an institution.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah.
I remember we had a viewing party for the last episode.
Of MASH.
Of MASH, yeah.
I know I've said this before, but that last episode, my cousin Susie had to do some open house. She was a teacher, and she was going to miss it. So I took my bright yellow Panasonic tape recorder and recorded just the audio for it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because we didn't have VCRs at that time. We didn't, anyway.
Yep.
So I remember going to a house and playing it for her. Okay, now listen to this. This is really tragic. And it was an amazing finale.
Sure.
Yeah
it was.
Yeah. Yeah, but what brings this up, I guess, today is tonight The Exorcist begins on Fox. And what I love about this show is that it's not a retread of the movie or any of the lesser movies after the original, The Exorcist. But it does this cool thing where when this priest thinks that there's maybe a demonic possession happening in this house, in his parish, he goes to research exorcisms and demons and stuff like that, and he comes across the story of the events of the original Exorcist. So they basically take those fictional events and make them part of the history of
this fictional story
now.
That's great.
You know, and it's also set for it having happened 40 years ago in the show too, which is really cool. And if you've ever seen the original Exorcist, when you see that newspaper clipping, you totally know.
Yeah,
you know what they're talking about, and it's just very cool. And then they only use the Tubular Bells theme song at the very end.
Oh, they do. Yeah.
And they had a big debate about whether the producers had a big debate about whether to use it or not at all. And then they thought, oh, well, you know, it kind of works at the end of this.
I think it pays nice
but
tribute.
That's the only time they're using it, though.
Is it the end of episode one,
tonight's
episode? It's shot here in Chicago.
And it's shot here in Chicago and all around. And I think it's going to be really cool because, you know, I had asked the guy who directed the first episode, if you know how they were going to get out of the house, because demonic possession things a lot of time, it's just in the one bedroom where right. the demon is possessing someone.
Right.
And he says that there's a larger story, and you know, I think there's sort of a larger, almost conspiracy happening that takes it beyond.
Yeah.
And like, I know they shot one episode, they shot a huge thing on an L. They got an L, and they had to do it late at night after the traffic was sort of done. So they went around the loop on the L and shot this whole scene.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So they will get out. Gina Davis is in it. Alan Ruck is in it.
Love him.
I love the song. That's why it sounds spookier when he's talking about it with the song by Mike
right.
Oldfield.
Right. And there's a bunch of other people in it, too. Alfonso Herrera, who's in Sense8. And then a couple of new actresses that I don't think would be recognizable. But it looks really good. I mean, the pilot was great, and I'm excited to see more of
good,
it.
Good, good.
But it starts tonight.
That's The Exorcist on Fox. Watch it tonight. And then there are plenty of other shows.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon started this week on Fox.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
All right, wait, hold the thought. Kurt Wagner's here of TVShowPatrol.com. We're talking about movies that have been adapted into TV series. TV is using a lot of them right now. We'll go through a couple more for you next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Kurt Wagner is here from TVShowPatrol.com. Have you been to the website, TVShowPatrol.com? I think you're going to like it. Today, Kurt is talking about movies that have been adapted, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, into TV series. Why all of a sudden, Kurt? I mean, there's always been a trickle of them, but right now there seems to be an overabundance. How
there
come,
is,
would you say?
There's a ton of them. Oh, before we go on, the actor in The Exorcist I forgot to mention was Ben Daniels, who's amazing as the actual exorcist.
Why do I know Ben Daniels' name? I've seen him in
he's
something.
He's been in a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's where I know him from.
Anyway, he's very intense.
Oh,
it's
good.
Very good. Anyway, so yes, why are there so many? Because I think...
Hollywood's out of ideas.
Well, they're either out of ideas or they don't want to take a chance on something... brand spanking new.
That's
and,
part of
you know,
it, isn't
these
it?
Things have built in audiences, they hope.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work out because there's been a lot of recent cancellations of these type of things.
Sure.
You know, I guess it just depends. But I think that's probably the biggest thing is that, you know, it's less of a risk.
I bet. You mentioned Lethal Weapon a little while ago. It's Damon Wayans who's taken on the Danny Glover role
right.
in this. And then
a guy named Clayne Crawford, who's really good as the Mel Gibson role. He had some really good moments in the pilot. I have to see a couple more of that before I decide whether it's... You know, the pilot seemed very...
Does it seem silly?
It seemed
yeah.
very, you know, standard. Let's just do it like the original.
Yeah.
You know, so... But we'll see.
Same kind of storyline, though,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Right?
The Clayne Crawford's... family has died, and so he comes to LA, but he's sort of on this mission to get himself killed.
Yeah.
By, you know, like, so he takes all these unnecessary risks
yeah.
when he's fighting crime. And Damon Wayne's character is a guy who was not far from retiring, but his wife just had a baby, which was an unexpected baby, you know?
Yeah.
And he just wants to sort of get through his time and be done, but then he has to get partnered up with this new guy who's
yeah.
very risk takes a lot of risks.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's
so
Wendy's story and mine.
Yeah.
You just told our story.
I'm the risky one.
Yeah. Yep. I'm too old for this. I'm ready to retire, but Wendy's a risk taker. On HBO, they're doing Westworld. Which for years I've said, why don't they remake Westworld? I love Westworld. They're doing it on HBO, but I'm hearing problems. They were supposed
to
run it, and then they postponed it.
Apparently, it wasn't as easy to do as one might think.
Yeah.
But I saw the first four episodes. They put them in the screening room last week, and I watched them. I was just going to watch one, and then I ended up watching all four. And I really like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's kind of moody and a little bit slow in parts, but by the time I got to the third and fourth episode were just like, whoa.
Oh, good.
Gangbusters.
What was Westworld again?
That was the Yul Brynner movie where they had created this world.
An amusement, a theme park.
Yeah, a theme park that was Western themed.
Ah.
And they were robots, right?
Right.
That you were interacting with. And people who had lots of money could go in.
James Brolin, Richard Benjamin were in the originals along with Yul Brynner. And I always thought that James Brolin's son, Josh Brolin, should recreate his role. But they didn't go with Josh Brolin. They went with somebody else. But Anthony Hopkins is in this.
Anthony Hopkins
wow.
is in it.
Tandy Newton's
in it.
She's good.
Yeah. I can't think of his name. That guy who was in Pollock, the Pollock movie.
I never saw it.
Anyway, lots of good people in it, though. James Marsden's in it.
Like him?
Yeah, he's cool.
Yeah.
But and this time around, they're, you know, it's more artificial intelligence because it's not in the 70s and, you know, it's newer. And so these robots are very...
very lifelike.
Yeah, very lifelike. Yeah.
Ed Harris?
Ed Harris, yeah.
Oh, Ed Harris.
Ed Harris
is
really good, yeah.
Oh, I like him. Good.
But the thing that struck me about this, as opposed to other, there's been, you know, artificial intelligence has been sort of the themes of movies and robots becoming sentient and all that kind of
sure.
stuff, you know. But what struck me about this that hasn't struck me about more recent things is how the humans who are paying big bucks to go here treat the robots
mm-hmm.
and how it sort of reflects on how... You know, I guess nowadays, maybe it's just because of the things that go on, but all the trolls and people on the internet who, you know, people say stuff on Facebook and on Twitter and on all those social media platforms about people that they would never say to their face,
sure, of course.
You know, and it's sort of that, it's sort of, I really saw a connection to that that I haven't seen in other things, like even within the last couple of years.
So this show, Westworld, premieres the first week in October,
yeah.
right on HBO.
The first Sunday, I believe, yeah.
That's right. That sounds yeah. right. Good. I'm anxious to see that.
Somebody wants to know when Better Call Saul is starting again.
Oh, good question.
That is a good question.
Probably next...
It's going to be a while?
Yeah. Isn't it a
they do
mid-season
a late season
thing?
Yeah.
yeah. Isn't it like January, somewhere around there? Isn't it a spring?
You're the television expert.
I believe it is.
And The Walking Dead starts October.
Yeah, it does. I think a week before Halloween.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
If I may, there's just one or two other movie adaptations that are mentioned here that I didn't even know they were making, much less are airing. Training Day, which
yeah.
was a great, great movie, a Denzel Washington movie that I love. That's coming to CBS.
In mid-season, so yeah. January probably.
That'll be good. Is Emerald City a TV take on Wizard of Oz?
It's, yeah. It's a little bit more Bizarro land, though. Bizarro yeah. Wizard of Oz, yeah.
And then
can it get more Bizarro, really, when you think about it?
Well, I think it's more adult, maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen any of it yet.
And then, is this already on, From Dusk Till Dawn?
Oh, yeah, that's in its third season right now on El Rey Network. And that started out as the same story as the movie, but then just filled in a lot of blanks and sort of expanded the universe.
Did you ever see that? That's Mm-mm. a Quentin Tarantino movie with George Clooney.
Really, I don't think I saw
really
that.
It's really a good movie.
Yeah.
It's strange, but good. And then I didn't even know. This is one that just got canceled, and if somebody told me it was on, I would have been happy to watch it. Damien, that's an offshoot of The Exorcist. That was a
no,
TV
The Omen.
Oh, The Omen. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The Omen.
Yeah.
That was a series?
Yeah, that
I
was on
no A&E
earlier this year, or last fall, one of the two. But I don't think it did very well, and it was him, like, when he was 30. He just turned 30.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and then he discovers that he might be who he might be.
Really quickly, I saw the new Kiefer Sutherland show that you recommended the other day.
Designated Survivor, yeah.
I watched that last night with my family. Did you see this, Wendy?
No.
It's really pretty good.
Yeah, I like the pilot. That's all I've seen, but I'm eager to see where it goes.
Yeah, you know, the big fear was because he was around terrorism in 24, people would go, well, it's Jack Bauer playing the president. But he really plays a very different character in this.
Right.
I like the difference.
I don't wonder if he will, because he won't, but... I was still waiting when I first saw the pilot for him to, you know, just bust out and
right.
crack some heads
right.
like, yeah. somewhere.
No, he plays almost a nerdish kind of...
Yeah.
Is he whispery in those too?
Yeah, he's always whispery. You have to turn your sound way up when
I
Kiefer
know.
Sutherland's on.
And then the commercials come on and zap your ears.
and he doesn't yell at Chloe at all.
No, there's none of that. There's none of that.
Or Edgar.
Yeah, that doesn't come up. Kurt, thank you. Always yeah. great to see you. That's Kurt Wagner. Again, his website is tvshowpatrol.com. It's a great one, so visit that if you love television. We'll take a quick break and then more show. Bill F. and Wendy Snyder with you on WGN. In a little bit, a new musical that's coming to town that I think you'll enjoy. We were just talking
about Moose and Squirrel?
About Moose and Squirrel, Wendy.
A musical.
A musical about Moose and Squirrel. We were just talking about movies that have been adapted for television shows, but what about this, a TV show that's been adapted to become a musical, or musical as some people say incorrectly. That's coming up right after the news, which is sponsored by the Gilkey Window Company. Here with the news is Kim Gordon. Sometimes you want to go where
everybody knows your name. I know your name.
Yeah, because I wear a name tag.
Thanks for that.
Yes.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And let me just say, Cheers ranked one of TV Guide's 50 greatest TV shows of all time. It aired for 11 seasons between the years 1982 and 1993. 26 Emmy Awards and 4 Golden Globe Awards.
Deserved.
Absolutely one of the best shows on TV. And now it's coming to the stage.
Right. I told Shelley Long at the end of the first season, you don't need this. Get out of this. This is a waste of your time.
Well, we are going to get to see Cheers live on stage. It opened Wednesday night at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower Place over on Chestnut. And in the studio with us right now is Carla Tortelli.
Hello.
Hello. Actually, she's Sarah Sirota.
Yep, that's right.
And Norm, how's it going?
Norm. Hi.
Norm Peterson, played by Paul Vogt.
Yeah.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
I'm sure you both watched this growing up. Is it surrealistic to be on stage playing the characters that you knew so well for so many years?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's such a treat. I mean, you see these people and you grow up admiring them, wanting to be in that bar with them, and to get to be on stage with everybody, bringing them back to life is such a treat.
That really, I know I was younger when Cheers was on, but it was so nice to go to a place where people knew your name, where you always found a friend. You could go there by yourself. And Sam Malone was hot.
Oh, he was. And he still is.
Yeah.
He is.
He's our not
Grayson
a bad looking
Powell.
Man. Yeah. Our Sam Malone's not bad looking. So, I mean, I'm the best looking in the show.
Well, obviously. So right. You don't need to point that out, Paul.
I know. It's what, radio.
What's the challenge in translating this? I mean, it worked so well. We know it as a TV show, but what about that transition to stage?
The good thing is the writing is the writing from the show. Mm-hmm. The Eric, who adapted the show, they took storylines from only season one because mm-hmm. there was so much to pull from. So they focused on season one. So as an actor, we're saying Emmy Award winning lines in comedy and stuff. So you dive into that and it takes care of you.
Mm-hmm.
The other aspect was not doing impressions, but bringing the essence of the character so that the audience felt comfortable and we could all go for this ride, but we're not trying to do an exact replica of it. So it's got a great energy. And when you're watching it, you're like, oh my gosh, I remember, you know, mm-hmm. it just brings everybody. There's a life to it doing it live theater that is exciting and fun and makes you remember the episode. And you're like, oh, I think I remember that line. And so I think the slight challenge is not doing an exact impression, but I think we've all found that. We've found a really great energy and a good way of attacking this beast.
And I think another thing about it is that on the TV show, they had the camera, and the camera could control your eye and where it goes.
Sure.
And one of the wonderful things about stage is that you're seeing the entire bar always,
yeah.
everyone, where they are, every reaction. It's not the camera controlling who you get to see.
So Carla's working. Carla,
yeah.
when we
she's
would do
making
rehearsals,
those tips.
She is taking orders. We're serving real drinks up
are
there.
Are you? Yeah.
So people are.
That was my first question. Will you be drinking real alcohol up there?
I drink the fake beer. Otherwise I'd be on the floor.
Right.
But there is I believe there's a VIP ticket that people can buy, and you can at intermission you get to come on stage and go on the set and have an actual real beer with alcohol.
That's cool.
And hang out on the cheer set. The set is
amazing
yeah. and gorgeous and elicits. When we first saw it, they had a curtain down, and when they played the music for us and the curtain went up, and we all cried like idiots.
Yes.
And then as actors, we wanted to get up on the playground and play.
Yeah.
So it's a the set's gorgeous. The costumes are perfect.
Amazing.
It really does transport you back. But what she's saying about on TV, it's a two-shot. It's a two-shot. She has to – it's not a two-shot. You're watching the whole thing. So her mm-hmm. and Coach and Sam are taking orders and delivering. If we messed up a line in rehearsal, we couldn't just go back one or two lines. We had to go all the way back to the top of the
reset.
Scene. Reset every bottle, every glass, and then start all over again.
Yeah.
You know?
What's so great about these stage shows with these old TV shows is just we all love nostalgia. We really do. Well, you mentioned something, Paul, about all of a sudden you go, wait, I think I remember that part, or I know what the next line's going to be.
Right.
That's what makes it fun and exciting.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's we've had young, 24-year-olds in Boston when we did the show. We had a group from UMass come,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't know Cheers. Which, you know, hurts my
soul.
But, those youngins.
Those darn youngins. They didn't know the show, so they watched it as a play. So they were interested to see who are these people, who are these characters.
Yeah,
and
right.
they were laughing at the jokes. And by the second act, they were there. They got who everybody was. They wanted to see where it was going to go. They were Cheers fans.
Yeah.
And that. So it's you know, it, bring anybody who has seen it, who hasn't seen it, you're going to get something out of it. You're going to get, you're going to fall in love with the Cheers world like we all did.
Because it's this experience of coming home, in a sense. Like right. Paul was saying about when the curtain goes up, or here in Chicago, when the lights come up on the set, people applaud. When I come out as Carla and go, okay, I'm late. People start clapping. They go
like,
crazy. And, you know, Paul walks out and everyone, the whole audience is yelling,
Norm!
Oh, nice.
Because yeah, it's fantastic.
People know these characters, and the people who didn't get to experience the show growing up, they realize all of a sudden they're in this big family.
Right.
In this world of coming home that they're like, oh, I could hang with these people.
Yeah.
Norm! Yeah, yeah. Norm!
So. And you know what's going to happen after someone who's never seen the show, millennials, they will maybe search it out and try watching it from the beginning, because what a great show that was.
Yeah, and one of the great things about this show is that it is that first season where, you know, the entire two-act play is a condensation of about, condensation like water, but it's bringing together, you know, like maybe six soup. Episodes from that first season where every character is introduced.
Right.
You get to meet these people for the first time.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing that people are going to go back and say, I want to meet them again. Let me see them on TV.
You have the blessing, I'm guessing, of the producers of the show. You must. I mean, it's down to the details. So they're aware of you. They're on your side. They want the show to succeed, right?
They laugh the most.
Did they really?
They laugh the hardest. Yeah. I mean,
you mean like the Cheers, the original Cheers folks?
Yeah, the people who put it together originally.
Yeah, I think it would just be one night if they didn't get approval. Well,
they don't know we're doing this. They won't hear this radio
no,
show.
No, of course
they?
Not. It's our secret.
But nobody listens to this.
I don't know if you guys remember years ago, somebody decided to put Cheers bars in airports all over the country with a fake Norm and a fake Cliff
really?
At the bar.
Oh, wow.
And the Cheers producers didn't exactly
CBS
think that was a good
idea.
CBS has
given their blessing.
Yeah,
for
CBS
this.
Is behind it. So, you know, and that's all the work they did before they even cast us.
Yeah.
But the producers and stuff have
is
had
it Glenn
all those.
Charles? Is that the man's name? For some
I
reason,
believe
that
it
seems
is.
To be.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. You see it on the
in
screen
the credits,
in your heads.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
With old timey guys from the 1920s
exactly.
holding beers.
Yeah, exactly.
And Jim Burrows.
Yeah, and Jim Burrows was the director.
Yeah.
Yeah, such an incredible show. I still remember, even though the show was a comedy, from time to time there were moments that grabbed you. The one that always stands out to me is when Diane decides she's going to leave for a little while, but then come back. They have a conversation she does with Ted Danson, and then she leaves, and he watches her leave, and he just says real quietly, have a great life, and then they fade to black. And I was a kid watching this going, he knows she's never coming back. It's so sad.
Yeah, the writing's fantastic. I mean, we have, again, I think they pulled together a really interesting script. It's a play.
Yeah.
And we have a couple moments. They've left a couple of those kind of moments in because it was so smart. It would make you laugh, make you laugh, make you laugh, make you think.
Mm-hmm.
Like without, and you're like, oh, I'm thinking now. I didn't realize that was going to happen in this. Which is why it won so many awards. And it's such a joy to do.
And I think that this show in particular, you know, you're watching two people who come from very different walks of life negotiating a relationship.
Right.
Which is something we can all relate to in a sense. You know, these two people... I like them, but I don't know if I should go forward. Should I? Should I not? He's so different than me, but I can't help but be attracted to him. And
it was a love-hate relationship in the truest sense of the term, wasn't it? They loved each other.
Which was fun for us to watch, and I think it set up for so many shows that came after that.
Oh, like, yeah.
Every show was looking for the oil and water couple. Who's, you know, who are we going to put on the show that's going to... We want them to get together. Oh, they're never going to get together.
Right.
You know,
fighting
to because they
them
did
on.
It so well.
Moonlighting.
Like friends.
Friends.
Yeah, friends. Mm-hmm.
Face the Nation. The list goes on and on and on.
It just goes on and on and on.
We're talking about Broadway and Chicago's latest production, Cheers, live on stage. More information next. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN. Broadway in Chicago is another hit on their hands. It's Cheers live on stage. It's playing at the Broadway Playhouse at Watertower Place. It just opened this past Wednesday. People are loving it. Two of the stars of the show, Sarah Sirota, who plays Carla Tortelli, is here. Paul Vogt, who plays Norm Peterson, is here. And everything's favorable. Everybody's very happy with what you guys are doing so far.
Phew!
So far.
In fact, we got a text that came over that said, took a group of 13 friends to the Cheers live show last night. It was such a fun performance, and everyone is absolutely loved it. Not a bad seat in the house. Go see it. How about that?
Oh, that's great.
It's
13 people.
Yeah, it is a great theater, too. It's a great space for this show.
Mm-hmm. And this
really
is the Broadway Playhouse at Watertower Place.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've never been there yet. I'm going to have to go.
Yeah.
How about this? The tour starts in Boston. And I guess everybody knows by now that's where Cheers took place is in Boston.
Right.
But your stay here in Chicago is longer than your stay in Boston. How come? What's behind that?
My personal thought is this is a comedy town.
Yeah.
They know comedy and they know theater. Mm-hmm. Like Chicago, it just embraces it. The Chicago people will go and see theater.
Right.
You know, you have Steppenwolf, you have the Goodman, all of that. And comedy is from Chicago.
Right.
I mean, other people might get mad at me, but I was on Matt TV for a few years, and we would come here and do the Comedy Improv Festival, and you couldn't walk down the street without somebody knowing who, even if we were on the show just for like a week.
Yeah.
Because this, Chicagoans know and love comedy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why we're here. It's a little bit smaller theater than we played in Boston, which we kind of like as actors because we like the intimacy of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's another thing, you know, to get enough people to come and watch the show. You want to be here more weeks, but that's what I think.
And I think that also being here is a great litmus test for the show in a sense, because Boston has so much pride about Cheers. I mean, while we were there, we went to the Cheers bar and
they had us,
you know,
over.
Had lunch, they had us over and everything. But here in Chicago, I mean, you know, we're in the heart of the country. And I think that people, this was a show that was on for 11 years. People loved it. Hopefully they'll love it here too and create that same. The great thing about the Broadway Playhouse is that it's intimate. And
right.
So this is a show about home. It's about being where you belong. And that house creates that feeling on stage for everyone who comes to the show. So
I hadn't gone to theater in a long time. My son was in Legally Blonde at his high school, and I was blown away by the stage setup there. But then I went to see SpongeBob, the musical, and I can't believe what all the stage setups are. And you said the bar, the Cheers bar. It's
a working bar. I mean, during intermission.
It's amazing to me.
It's beautiful.
Drinks.
It looks just like the TV show. I mean, it's honestly, you will have an emotional response when you see it.
You can,
like,
go around the set and go, oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
the stairs
that go upstairs to the restaurant that was above them. We enter down the stairs because Cheers is a basement bar.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all there.
That frosty glassed window.
Exactly.
That you can see.
See, you're starting.
Yes.
You're starting.
Exactly.
What does that say, do you think, about our intellect where just a set of something, like you could see meeting a person where you go, hey, I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Right.
But when you're just seeing a set, and in this case, it's a recreation of a set, but it still has such an emotional attachment. Isn't that interesting?
Well, the bar really was another character in the show.
Yeah.
And people have this attachment to that set. They applaud just seeing it. It was like this other character. And we have this great thing about our show where if you go to CheersLiveOnStage.com, you can apply to be an audience member on stage.
Oh, cool.
And you get to come backstage. You're put in 80s costume, full out. And you become part of the show. You sit on stage. I serve you. You're up there with me and Paul and everybody else. And part of it. And that's, I think, what the bar does. It's another character in the show.
Yeah, that's very, very cool.
And it's also the theme song, too, because it came out, you know, there was a few years that theme songs were incredible. The Friends theme song. But the Cheers is one of those theme songs. So when they play that at the beginning and you see the bar, you're getting hit twice
with
emotional recall.
And everyone knows the lyrics, so I'm guessing they're singing along with that to some extent, too. Huh?
Yeah,
we have a little sing-along at the end, too.
Yeah, yeah. As actors, I know you're auditioning for new things all the time, but when somebody says, hey, you're going to play these iconic roles, how do you prepare for that? Like you said earlier, Paul, you don't want to do an impression, really, but you want to capture the essence. So what's going on in your head when you're auditioning for something you've seen for so long?
Well, for me, when I got the call for the audition, I went back and I watched Rhea doing her thing, and she was amazing.
Yeah.
She was
four
great.
Emmys for this.
Yeah,
she was, you can't touch her in a sense. And me and Rhea actually have a lot in common. We're both born and raised in New York. We're both under 5'4", you know, short girls with kooky curly hair. And so for me, this part was really a returning to my roots. It was about embracing everything that's kind of at the core of who I am, embracing my kooky curly hair, embracing that I'm, I mean, it was the first time in an audition where I was like, oh yes, I'm 5'2½". And embracing my true New York accent. And so it's a returning to my roots for me, bringing curly back, that kind of
that's
thing.
That's awesome.
And you? For you?
I've always wanted to sit on a stool and drink fake beer.
Right.
And
so
this was
well.
Like the last thing on my bucket list. So now I have nothing else left to do.
You can die happy.
I'm probably going to end it all. It's kind of a similar thing. I've actually know George Wendt.
Oh, you do, yeah?
Yes, we're friends and we've done a few shows together. So in the audition, I did a video audition because I'm based out of LA and they are auditioning everybody in New York. And I knew the director, Matt Lenz, and he said, yes, send a video. And I went to do the video and I don't have a mug in my house. I don't have one glass with a handle.
Oh.
And I was like surprised by that, even though I've lived there for 12 years. I had no idea I didn't have a mug. And I'm like, it's norm. I have to have a mug of beer. Like,
right.
It has to happen. So we had two Boddingtons, which are really tall, you know, beers in the fridge from somebody had stopped over. And I took the blender carafe and filled it with the beer and stood there. And when they filled me, I said, give me a beer, Sam. And they just handed me the blender carafe and I would sip out of it. And at the end, I just said, it's a little light here. You want to top it off? And then Matt said, oh, my God, the blender thing was perfect. So I really got hired not because of my talent, but because my props were really funny.
Vitally important.
Which I
Gallagher is proud of you.
Yes. It's the Gallagher method, I believe, is what they teach now.
Exactly. Isn't it funny? They never showed George's wife, Vera, on any episodes. They never showed her. And then there's an episode where Sam Malone's brother comes for a visit, and he's in every scene, but you never see him. The crowd is always standing around him, so you don't
and
get to see
him.
And
that's in our show, actually.
That's both, yeah, both things. We talk about Vera for a bit, and the Derek storyline is part of our show, and we do the same thing where you just like you see like the top of his head,
right?
Yeah. The actor play and he has lines and he actually sings a little bit of a song, and because Derek was this super wonder man that Sam couldn't deal with, and that's it's a big part of the show. But we do the same thing. We don't
excellent
show him, so it's really funny.
And well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that the funny thing is it's this time before cell phones. I mean, back then in the 80s in Cheers, you could hide from people.
Yep.
Norm could hide from his wife, Vera, and say, oh, I'm not here.
Right.
Right? We say that in the show, like, when the phone rings, who's not here?
Yeah. You know?
Carla can hide from her kids. You can't do that nowadays.
Right, true.
Someone's on your cell phone, it's like,
can't
no
get away.
No secrecy anymore.
Yeah.
And Ranker.com does the best TV theme songs of all time. Number one, Cheers, of course. So
you hear those notes and it just starts.
Beautiful.
Everybody knows your name.
Boom, boom. I hope you guys have a huge hit on your hands. I don't know how you could possibly miss. It's Broadway in Chicago's new musical, Cheers, live on stage. We've been talking to two of the stars, Sarah Sirota, who plays Carla, Paul Vogt, who plays Norm. You want to go to BroadwayInChicago.com. All the ticket information is there. Good luck, you guys.
Thanks so much. I hope you guys see it.
I'll take a quick break and then find out what Steve has coming up next on the business lunch. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right, Steve Bertrand is here, ready to start the Wintrust business lunch.
We are going to talk about the pet industry and veterinary care for pets and how much money Americans spend on all of that, billions of dollars every year. That's coming up with the CEO of SIVA. Craig Wallace is his name. Also, we talked on this show, I think it was about college recruiting and getting your kid a scholarship to be an athlete.
Yeah.
And there's a group called NCSA. We'll talk to the head of softball recruiting. She's a coach, used to play for Drake, about how to prepare your, you know, because there's a whole method to it. It's not just showing up and playing well. All of that coming up. Andrea Haynes as well from Blue Sky Innovation. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. The news is sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems. Here's Kim Gordon.